Hello and welcome to Battlecast. I'm Dr. Luke Wolf, and today we're plunging right back into Vietnam with the Battle of Y Dong, made famous in the Mel Gibson film We Were Soldiers. In this battle, Colonel Hal Moore and seven companies of Americans are going to find themselves cut off and surrounded by thousands of angry North Vietnamese regulars. These weren't farm boys running around playing soldier in the woods, but well-trained soldiers. Soldiers who knew how to set up ambushes, who knew how to dig spider holes. Soldiers, in short, who knew how to give and receive death. The Americans would be dancing with them. But first, I've got to thank Jim from Redding, California, and Afonso, all the way from Braga, Portugal, for buying us around. I also need to thank Ben from Parts Unknown for filling up the fridge. And if you'd like to buy us around, head over to thebattlecast.com and hit that make a donation button. But now it's time for yet another epic story of modern warfare. It's the Battle of Y Dong. Lieutenant Colonel Peter Schifferle provides the perfect background for the Battle of Y Dong, so I'll just quote him. Quote, President Diem of South Vietnam had been overthrown in a U.S.-supported coup and was assassinated on November 1, 1963. After his death, the domestic political turmoil in South Vietnam increased, and so did the attacks by the Viet Cong insurgents. By late December, key presidential advisor McNamara warned President Johnson that South Vietnam was in danger of being overwhelmed by communist attack. On January 29, 1964, yet another U.S.-sanctioned coup paralyzed South Vietnamese execution of the counterinsurgency. The effectiveness of South Vietnamese counterinsurgency efforts had evaporated. Over the winter of 1963 to 1964, and American policy advisors differed over the proper U.S. response. The Joint Chiefs of Staff recommended strong U.S. commitment of air and ground forces to assist the counterinsurgency effort. But President Johnson restated U.S. policy was advisory and economic support only. A change did occur, however, in the American approach to the war in the spring of 1964. Concern over the increasing aggression of North Vietnam as opposed to the war of insurgents in South Vietnam began to become the focus of attention of the policymakers. By the spring of 1964, the South Vietnamese government controlled fewer than 40% of its population. The Viet Cong was growing daily in personnel, strength, skill, and power, and the government of South Vietnam seemed impotent to stop the insurgency. End quote. In response to numerous North Vietnamese attacks on American personnel and bases, President Johnson implemented Operation Rolling Thunder, which entailed a massive bombing campaign of North Vietnam. One of the largest bombing campaigns in human history. There was a problem, though. All those planes stationed in South Vietnam needed protection, reliable protection. As a consequence, American ground forces were committed to South Vietnam in order to protect the massive number of American-built installations dotting South Vietnam. However, instead of just sitting behind fences waiting for the communists to attack the Americans at their leisure, the Americans went out into the area near the bases in order to engage the enemy before he attacked them. As a consequence, American casualties, and it should be pointed out, South Vietnamese communist insurgent casualties increased dramatically. J.D. Caldwell explains what happened next, quote, the chain of events running up to the Battle of Y Dong Valley began in the fall of 1965 in the Central Highlands with a North Vietnamese attack on a special forces camp at Ply May, which the Green Berets repulsed. To pursue the enemy, General Westmoreland committed the 1st Cavalry Division to combat less than a month after it had arrived in country. The result was the Battle of the Y Dong Valley, named for a small river that flowed through the tactical area. For 35 days, Americans would engage North Vietnamese forces in running combat all the way to the borders of Cambodia, end quote. This is the story of that battle. John Cash explains the importance of the Battle of Y Dong. It upended the pattern of warfare which had taken place for years in Southeast Asia. After Y Dong, things would never be the same. Up to the fall of 1965, the fighting by U.S. troops in Vietnam had been characterized, for the most part, by hit-and-run counterinsurgency operations against Viet Cong irregulars. It was during the week before Thanksgiving, amidst the scrub brush and stunted trees of the Yijong River Valley in the western sector of Pleiku Province, along the Cambodian border, that the war changed dramatically. For the first time, regular North Vietnamese regiments, controlled by a division-sized headquarters, engaged in a conventional contest with U.S. forces. North Vietnamese General Chu Hu Man's headquarters had conceived a bold plan for operations in the Central Highlands of South Vietnam. End quote. Now, both sides of this conflict knew the importance of the Central Highlands. Any idiot who could read a map could see it. First, the terrain was mountainous and difficult, offering clear lines of ground attack that could easily be ambushed. Second, if the North Vietnamese controlled the Central Highlands, they could use it as a base for launching attacks across all of South Vietnam, including the all-important coastal areas, which, in case you didn't know, are the key choke points of American military power. I mean this in a geopolitical sense. America and her allies' control of the oceans, even today, is integral to the United States' power. Take the coast of a place, and you cut off America from her allies on land. Anyway, if the Vietnamese threatened the coastal centers, at the very least, it would force the South Vietnamese and Americans to commit large forces to defense, and thereby weaken the communist enemy. On the other side of the equation, American overall commander General Westmoreland could read maps just as well as any North Vietnamese general. He knew the importance of the highlands, and he also knew if he could concentrate the enemy in the highlands, the overwhelming power of American technological warfare would decimate the insurgents. Now, back in Hanoi, General Chu Hu Man knew the importance of power, the capacity to nullify the enemy. Accordingly, his plan of attack was a lesson in Carl Schmitt's philosophy of power. First, the North Vietnamese would destroy American Special Forces camps in the region. Next, key population centers, including the city of Pleiku, would be captured. Afterwards, all of the South Vietnamese and American forces would either be destroyed or nullified. It follows just as easy as a mathematical proof that the Central Highlands would thereafter be a base for North Vietnamese power. But things weren't so simple. They never are they? From the start, Chu Hu Man's plan went wrong, like it always does. First, in late October or early November, the communists attacked a special forces camp called Ply May. Now, I should point out that the sources differ on the actual date of the North Vietnamese attack on Ply May. The date doesn't matter. What does matter is the attack was repulsed, and American commander Westmoreland literally sent in the cavalry to track down the northern forces who had launched the attack. A modern historian explains what happened next. Quote, "By the end of October, two North Vietnamese regiments were being pursued by units of the 1st Cavalry Division in the Pleiku area. When Ply May Camp was threatened, the 1st Brigade engaged in intensive search and destroy as well as reconnaissance in force operations, most of them involving fierce fighting, and most of them were successful. Concerned that the North Vietnamese might slip away entirely, Major General Harry Kennard, the 1st Cavalry Division commander, directed his men to press the search vigorously with squad and platoon saturation patrolling. 3 days later, on November 13th, when patrolling turned up few North Vietnamese, General Kennard ordered his men to search westward toward the Cambodian border. The Americans focused their attention on the densely wooded area south of the Yijang River at the base of the Chu Pong Massive, a rugged mountain straddling the South Vietnamese-Cambodian border. On November 10th, General Chu Hu Man, undismayed by his heavy losses and the failure at Ply May, decided to try again on November 16th. The staging area his headquarters selected in preparation for the new attack included the very terrain Major General Kennard had chosen to search. Thousands of North Vietnamese were gathering in the area, and the American cavalry would be flying right into the middle of them. The man who would be leading one of the most threatened American elements was Lieutenant Colonel Harold Moore, commander of the 1st Battalion, 7th Cavalry, whose exploits were made famous in the book and film We Were Soldiers Once and Young. On November 14th, Moore and his approximately 700 men made their way by helicopter to the base of Chu Pong. They were going on the attack, end quote. But sometimes, as the sayings of the Spartans point out, the fleeing mouse turns and fights back against the threatening cat. And that was just what was about to happen to the American pursuers. Colonel Harold Moore remembers his battalion's initial assault at Yijong like this, quote, The pilot pulled pitch and lifted off, and we were bound for the landing zone. We flew over a broad, slightly rolling plain dotted with trees 30 to 50 feet tall, interspersed with a few old farm clearings, small winding streams, and dry stream beds. We saw no villages and no people. In the field in Vietnam, all days were the same, hot and wet or hot and dry, but always dangerous. The troop doors on the Hueys were open. We flew at 2,000 feet to reduce the chances of being hit by enemy small arms fire as we traversed 14 miles of hostile country. We flew in four groups of four helicopters each. Captain John Heron was there, and he recalls the scene like this. It was a misty, cool morning with some low-hanging fog when we lifted off. But shortly after takeoff, we broke into the clear, and you could see the artillery pounding the areas around the landing zone as we headed in. Vietnam, even in war, was scenic with the green jungle, heavy forested mountains, and wild-looking rivers crisscrossing the terrain. We were 2 minutes out now, and we could see smoke and dust flying around the landing zone. Major Bruce Crandall recalls what happened next, quote, "We went low level and arrived right on schedule at the release point in the landing zone. The landing zone was not as clear of obstacles as we would have liked, but we got our flight in without any real problems. The only movement we spotted in the landing zone was something that looked like a dog scampering into some underbrush on the far side. It was probably an enemy soldier. Now the door gunners on the lift ships were firing into the tree line as we dropped into the clearing. I unhooked my seatbelt, switched the selector switch on my M16 to full automatic rock and roll, and fired bursts into the brush to the left towards the mountain. As Crandall came in hot and flared over the dry 5-foot-tall elephant grass, as the chopper skids touched the ground, I yelled, "Let's go!" and jumped out, running for the trees on the western edge of the clearing, firing my rifle as I came on. I ran across the 25 yards of open ground, then across a waist-deep, 10-foot-wide dry creek bed, and continued running some 75 yards into the scrub brush, leading the command group. We snapped fired at likely enemy positions as we ran. We stopped to slap fresh magazines into our rifles as we came on. So far, we had been unopposed. The heavily forested eastern slopes of the Chu Pong rose steep and dark, more than 1,000 feet above the clearing. The massive's lower slopes were covered with thick green foliage, elephant grass, and tangles of brush. Gullies and long fingers of ground led from the bottom of the mountain and blended into the woods and the dry creek bed where we stood. Plenty of places for people to hide. Plenty of places for enemy to kill. The creek bed, just inside the western edge of our clearing, was an excellent route of approach for enemy troops coming from the direction of the mountain or the valley, and for us going the other way. That creek bed was a critical feature. We quickly began search and destroy operations while other platoons secured the landing zone. End quote. It wouldn't be long before Harold Moore found the enemy, or rather, the enemy found Harold Moore. As Moore's men landed, General Chu Hu Man was watching them all from the mountaintop, seeing everything while screaming for his adjutant so he could issue new orders. Now he finally had the Americans where he wanted them, and he wasted no time in diverting his nearby troops towards Moore and his battalion. The general's plan was simple. Two regiments would surround and destroy the Americans at the landing zone. It was easy and as simple as lusting after a woman. A few minutes later, one of Moore's men made his first capture. It was a North Vietnamese soldier. He was unarmed, and Moore's men quickly brought him in as a prisoner of war. The prisoner claimed to be a deserter, and he squealed all the information he had like the three little pigs. The North Vietnamese were embedded on the mountain, and they wanted a fight. Hal Moore was determined to give it to him. He actually nodded when he heard the news. Moore quickly dispatched three platoons in a sweep line near the bottom of the mountain. The rightmost platoon quickly encountered the enemy and was attacked on the flank, taking numerous casualties in the firefight. Now the Battle of Y Trong had begun. Eyewitness Daniel Deed remembers that moment. Quote, "Devney's platoon was taking moderate fire. We could all hear it through the foliage, and I heard it crackling on my radio. The firing increased in volume and intensity. Then I saw my first wounded trooper. He was shot in the neck and was still carrying his rifle. Was able to walk and appeared stunned, which I bet all of us would be after a 7.62 round passed a millimeter away from your windpipe. When he asked where to go, I put my arm around him and pointed to where I had last seen the battalion commander. Here's what Sergeant Jimmy Jakes of Phoenix City, Alabama, who was leading four men in one of Devney's rifle squads, remembers, quote, "As we were advancing towards the enemy, two of my men and one from another squad were hit by machine gun fire. I was ordering men to my left and right. Some didn't even belong to our platoon. I yelled to them to lay down a base of fire. Then I crawled to aid the wounded. I was able to drag two of the wounded back to our defense line. We had stopped advancing at this point. As I attempted to drag a third back, I myself was wounded," end quote. An AK-47 round penetrated Jake's side and exited out his shoulder. It was a wound that would play hell on his shoulder press. The back of his shoulder looked like a jar of marinara shattered on a wooden floor, just wet, chunky blood everywhere. At this time, one of the other platoons was attempting to support the pinned down platoon, but instead they ran into the enemy and became involved in a sporadic running firefight with North Vietnamese regulars. That's when men in the leading squad noticed about 20 Vietnamese scrambling behind some giant, man-sized anthills preparing to ambush the Americans. Well, the Americans had an answer to that, 40 millimeters of an answer. Grenade launchers. As the lead squad laid down fire on the Vietnamese behind the anthills, the grenadier found the range and began working shrapnel into the fragile bodies of the communists. The men could hear screams from the anthills as the flying chunks of metal peppered the bodies of their enemies. The leading American squad was having a good time of it. And that's when fate decided to flip the tables. From out of nowhere, on the right flank, a volley of enemy rifle fire careened into the American squad. The grenadier, who had been dealing death as easily as a Vegas poker dealer, had his chest blown out in the opening fusillade. He died a few seconds later as his mouth, fish-like, gasped for air that would not come. A minute later, he was crossing the River Styx with Virgil. At the same time, the rest of the squad was pinned down. There were more Americans getting pinned down than posters on a college bulletin board. John Cass picks up the story, quote, "Deploying two M60 machine guns towards the harassed force, the commander of the leading platoon yelled to the third squad leader to pull back under covering fire of the machine guns. Yet even as the gunners moved into firing position and the platoon commander radioed for help, the situation grew worse. Within a few minutes, fire was lashing the entire third platoon from all sides. Covered by the blazing M60, Sergeant Savage managed to withdraw his squad towards the platoon, carrying the M79 grenade launcher of the dead grenadier who lay sprawled where he had fallen, a .45 caliber pistol clutched in his right hand. He could hear the heavy sound of 7.62 ammunition blowing little geysers of dirt and tree splinters into the landscape around him. That could be my face, he thought, as two rounds split a wrist-sized tree in half. Savage would later describe the start of the battle like this, quote, "We had one hell of a firefight for 4 minutes. We killed a lot of them. I personally hit a lot of them. There were targets everywhere, like in a movie. I saw them fall myself. The enemy tried to put a machine gunner on our right, but we solved that problem with an M79 grenade. We were pumping grenades into them, shooting up volcano bursts of dirt and debris, but the Vietnamese just kept coming," in inner quote. Amid increasing heavy fire of all calibers, including mortars and rockets, the squad reached the main body of the platoon and joined the other men in the hastily forming 25-meter perimeter. The machine gunners were less fortunate in making their way into the perimeter, although the closer team managed to disengage and crawl into the small circle of prone infantrymen. Enemy fire cut down all four in the other team. The men gave their lives for South Vietnam, and scores of their family would weep for the day President Johnson decided to contain communism in Southeast Asia. Seizing the fallen team's M60, the North Vietnamese turned it against Herrick's position. Now it was the Americans' turn to get raked over with automatic machine gun fire, and say what you want about the North Vietnamese, but they could shoot just as straight as any American, end quote. It was the first few hours of battle, and already American units were cut off from one another. Their commanders were scrambling to get them aid, but with few units available, what aid could they get? They had already committed the reserve platoon, and now there was no more immediate reinforcements to commit. Things were going from bad to worse. The immediate superior in charge of the cut-off 3rd platoon, Captain Heron, was desperately trying to organize reinforcements when he saw something move from the corner of his eye. He paused, looked to his right, and saw death staring him in the face. A North Vietnamese regular was aiming an AK-47 at his chest. Heron didn't hesitate. Cat-like, he shot a burst from his M16 as he drop to the ground. A second later, he sent a hand grenade flying towards Heron's adversary, no longer a commander but a man under fire. Heron's stomach crawled his way to the nearest Americans. The Vietnamese were putting so much pressure on the Americans that the command structure was breaking down. Now, one of the most important decisions of the entire battle had just taken place. Hal Moore explains the importance in his book, We Were Soldiers. The historian S.L.A. Marshall wrote that, at the beginning of a battle, units fractionalize, groping between the antagonists takes place, and the battle takes form from all of this. Marshall had it right. That is precisely what was happening up in the scrub brush above Landing Zone X-ray this day, and no other single event would have a greater impact on the shape of this battle than what Lieutenant Henry Herrick was in the process of doing. Herrick charged right past Lieutenant Devney's men, swung his platoon to the right in hot pursuit of a few fleeing enemy soldiers, and disappeared from sight into the brush, alone, cut off, dangerous. Says Sergeant Ernie Savage of Herrick's orders, quote, "He made a bad decision, and we knew at the time it was a bad decision. We were breaking contact with the rest of the company. We were supposed to come up to the flank of the first platoon. In fact, we were moving away from them. We lost contact with everybody," end quote. Herrick's men were now more than 100 yards away from their nearest support, isolated and cut off. Soon they would be surrounded with devastating consequences. At this time, more American troops were landing. Colonel Moore ordered these newly arriving soldiers to assist Heron's 3rd platoon as soon as they were on the ground. The problem was they weren't all on the ground yet. Moore checked his watch. It was 1:30 in the afternoon, and there was a lot of daylight left for killing. Already the men had to scream at each other just to be heard, and this is in the supposedly secure landing zone. That's when Moore heard something strange. Lightning was crashing all around them. Lightning in the middle of a beautiful day. Only it wasn't lightning. It was mortar rounds. Rounds which were landing right in the middle of the elephant grass covered landing zone. The enemy had already found the range. Their fire was accurate. Death was coming. Colonel Moore takes up the story, quote, "Just now the snaps and cracks of the rounds passing nearby took on a distinctly different sound, like a swarm of bees around our heads. I was on the radio trying to hear a transmission over the noise when I felt a firm hand on my right shoulder. It was Sergeant Major Plumley's hand. He shouted over the racket of the firefights, 'Sir, if you don't find some cover, you're going to go down. And if you go down, we all go down.' The sergeant major was right. Things were getting a little dicey," end quote. Moore sent a platoon to try and reach Heron's cutoff men and hastily set up an all-around defense of his landing zone. Still, the rear of the landing zone was weakly held. If the enemy pushed hard there, it might be the ball game. However, Moore felt he had no choice considering the developing situation. Already, Moore was trying to apply America's technological superiority to the battle situation. He radioed for artillery, air, and rocket fire to be directed at the likely approaches of the enemy, what soldiers call the lines of drift. Many terrains have these lines of drift, areas where most humans will naturally walk across a landscape. When you know how to read these lines of drift, you've taken an important step in becoming a good officer or a good insurgent. John Cash picks up the story, quote, "A few minutes later, aircraft were blasting the target areas. And 2 strikes were made on the valley floor to the northwest near the suspected location of the enemy battalion. Although the artillery also responded quickly, the fire was at first ineffective. Since there were no well-defined terrain features that could be used as reference points to the fighting troops, now hidden by a heavy pall of dust and smoke that hung in the air, it was hard to pinpoint locations for close-in support. Aware of the difficulty, Colonel Moore radioed Whiteside to use the technique of walking the fires down the mountain towards the landing zone from the south and the west, and fires were soon close enough to aid some of the embattled infantry men. Meanwhile, American troops under the command of an officer named Lieutenant Marm were trying to link up with the other cut-off Americans. They were at a dry creek bed when the men spotted a force of khaki-clad enemy soldiers moving across their front left to right. The Americans had apparently met the left enveloping pincer, which had initially flanked the first cut-off platoon and which was now attempting to surround all of Company B. A fierce firefight ensued, both sides taking casualties. The enemy soldiers then peeled off to the left, breaking contact momentarily and, unknown to Lieutenant Marm, trying to maneuver behind Marm via the dry creek bed. Taking advantage of the lull, Marm collected all his wounded and ordered them taken back to the landing zone. Marm's men tried to take the wounded, but they returned 20 minutes later to report that the platoon was surrounded. Marm doubted that the enemy could have moved that fast, but he could not be sure since enemy troops were now maneuvering to his flank also. When the North Vietnamese of the flanking force, estimated at 100 to 200 men, entered the dry creek bed, they ran headlong into the rest of Company A. First to meet the enemy in the creek bed was the 3rd Platoon. The firing was at very close range, and it was savage. The platoon leader, Lieutenant Robert E. Taft, going to the aid of one of his squad leaders, was himself hit in the throat and died instantly. Recoiling from the first shock, the men of the left half of the 3rd Platoon climbed onto the creek bank, where they poured a murderous fire into the enemy scampering through the creek bed. Bodies were everywhere. End quote. Specialist Carmen Maselli was there, and this is what he saw. Quote, "We were told to drop our packs. We got on a sweep line and moved forward in the attack. I saw Bill Beck working an M60 machine gun out to my left, just pumping rounds in the creek bed. You could see the dirt popping up in little geysers and trees splintering into like toothpicks where the big rounds of the M60 hit. The enemy who took rounds spun around like figure skaters as the high caliber ammunition penetrated their flesh. They were forming pirouettes of death, becoming ballerinas of pain," we said. "We started taking fire and guys started going down, our own men, I mean. Men would be firing and screaming and then just crumple into the dirt. It was like getting hit by a heavyweight boxer, Mike Tyson. We could see the enemy plainly. We were assaulting and a lot of our guys were hit right away. A lot of theirs were too," end quote. Sergeant Steve Hansen takes up the story, quote, "We ran into a wall of lead. Every man in the lead squad was shot. It was like peppering a steak for the grill or something. The bullets just ran up and down our position. The enemy was very close to us and overran some of our dead. The fire was heavy, and so we had to pull back. There was nothing else we could do," end quote. Another eyewitness remembers what happened to a man named Lieutenant Taft, quote, "The lieutenant glanced at me, turned back to his front, and took 4 more steps. Then he fired 2 shots at something. The next thing I knew, he just dropped face down on the ground. It was like an invisible hand had shoved him down like a rag doll. Taft was hit. When I rolled him over, I saw he was shot in his throat and a round had come out his left side. The bullet had run a circuit inside his body. He was dead as it can be, and it was difficult to even move the man, even though he was a slightly built guy. You may not know this, but it's not easy to carry a dead body," end quote. To put the situation succinctly, one hell of a firefight was taking place around the American spearhead. More American troops were moving towards the cutoff men, trying to help them, but they still hadn't reached the contact point yet. It was about 2:00 in the afternoon, and there was plenty of time for more killing. More American reinforcements continued to arrive at the landing zone, but the enemy was so close even the pilots, let alone the infantrymen, were getting hit by shell and rifle fire. A military historian provides the details, quote, "Captain Louis Lefebvre, the Company D commander, in the lead helicopter could see the airstrikes and artillery fire slamming into the ground of the landing zone. It looked like the ground was simply exploding open, as if God was cursing the very earth itself. Leaning forward to unhook his seatbelt, as the aircraft touched down, he felt a bullet crease the back of his neck. Instinctively, he turned to the right just in time to see his radio operator slump forward, still buckled in his seat, a smoking bullet hole in the left side of his head. Grabbing the dead man's radio, Lefebvre jumped from the helicopter, told those assembled who had landed in other ships to follow, and raced for the tree line to the west, 75 meters away. Only 4 men followed him. Under fire all the way, they reached the relative safety of the dry creek bed, 35 meters short of the tree line. So heavy was the fire that Colonel Moore radioed the remaining 8 helicopters not to land. So much for the desperately needed reinforcements. Sporadic rocket and mortar fire, the crash of artillery volleys, and the thunderclap of airstrikes that were now ringing the small clearing blended into one continuous roar. Captain Lefebvre heard fighting in front of him and on both sides. His small group had moved into position just to the right of Company A's 2 platoons, which were still battling the force that had attempted to flank Marm's platoon. Lefebvre and his men joined the firing from their positions in the creek bed, their immediate targets 25 to 30 North Vietnamese moving to the left across their front. Soon realizing the need for more firepower, Lefebvre called for another rifle platoon to join him. Just as the radio operator joined him, Captain Lefebvre looked up to see Captain Herron, The Company B commander told him that there were enemy soldiers south in the direction from which he had just come. He and his radio operator took positions beside Lefebvre and began firing along with the others. In rapid succession, Heron's radio operator was killed. Lefebvre's right arm was shattered into a candy cane-infused melted strawberry sundae by a fusillade of enemy small arms fire, and another man received a bad leg wound. Heron applied a tourniquet to Lefebvre's arm and then resumed firing. End quote. Meanwhile, helicopter loads of troops under fire continued to arrive. Colonel Moore threw them into the battle line as they arrived. Often they were just in time to stop a human wave of 200 Vietnamese, and you should have seen the M60 machine guns mechanically work death into a wave of onrushing humans, the bullets hissing and slicing down the elephant grass, pasta sauce bursting from Vietnamese heads as they implode, the heads exploding as if two invisible hands clapped a water balloon, the bodies flipping like hyperactive teenagers in rural parking lots on a Saturday night, screams, unholy screams, scores of men falling on top of each other, sliced like corned beef, finding out if atheism really is true or not, the bullets running into the feedway of the chattering machine gun, the shells spilling out like metallic confetti, the hinged shoulder rest jiggling the subcutaneous fat of the gunners, their shoulders black and blue from the continuous firing, but still spasmodically working the trigger, adrenaline smothering their pain, their blinking eyes stinging from the streaming sweat. If the reinforcements had arrived just 5 minutes later to the landing zone, the entire position may well have been overrun, but lying prone amid the elephant grass and utilizing their vast superiority in artillery and airstrikes, the Americans were able to hold off the human wave assaults that probed the perimeter of the landing zone. A novelist pictures the scene like this, quote, Lieutenant Nguyen and his company snaked as close to the tree line as they could. Then Nguyen blew a whistle, and hundreds of North Vietnamese regulars leapt to their feet, screaming and charging toward the American lines. The M60s opened up first. The tracers resembled lasers from the film Star Wars, as the machine gun rounds worked mechanized death into the onrushing communists. One man's arm simply exploded, as if it had burst open from the inside, a giant bloody pimple exuding pus and blood and bone. Another Vietnamese, with a face of hate, ready to die for Buddha and his fatherland, had dreamed of the fight against the Americans ever since his sister had been napalmed in a small South Vietnamese village. This was his chance, but his chance never materialized because he caught a 40-millimeter grenade in his chest, ripping his body apart the way the T-1000 explodes at the end of Terminator 2. He resembled nothing more than a burnt lasagna accidentally splattered across the floor by a careless cook. Still, the human wave tsunamied forward. That's when the artillery rounds started to hit, sending eruptions of earth and human flesh commingling into the blue sky. Airstrikes came next, working misshapen shrapnel into the oncoming Vietnamese, dusting them with death, the way a carnival worker powders a funnel cake. Still, the shrunken human wave came on. That's when the surviving Vietnamese threw themselves to the ground and began to exchange rifle fire with the American battle line. Now the heavier, more powerful 7.62 rounds from the communists began to burst open American bodies. 1 minute a soldier would be talking to you, the next minute his head would explode like a scene from the film Scanners, covering you with blood and gore just as easy as a 9-year-old obnoxiously slathers ketchup on French fries. But even though the Americans were taking casualties, the wave had finally stopped. The way the Pacific waves crash and subside before the concrete Tokyo seawall, there would be no decisive overrunning of the American position. Nevertheless, the Vietnamese probing continued, and the sun lingered in the sky, giving light to all the death playing out below it, as if it were purposely, malevolently slowing down in order to make the spectacle of pain and disfiguration last longer. End quote. All right, so let me give you an overview of where we are in this battle. It's approximately 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and Colonel Moore has set up an all-around defensive position surrounding his landing zone. In the landing zone itself, small arms fire and mortar rounds are probing the helicopters and men within the perimeter. In addition, one platoon is cut off and outside this perimeter, fighting for its life. Outside the perimeter, the North Vietnamese are probing the entire circular-shaped front line of the landing zone stop lines. John Cash and Alan Sandstrom provide a masterful and succinct explanation of what happened next, so I'll just quote them. Quote, the intensity of the fighting increased, as did the noise. hit by a heavy enemy ground fire while making a low-level firing pass over the landing zone. An AIE Sky Raider aircraft trailing smoke and flames crashed 2 kilometers northeast of the landing zone, killing the pilot. When enemy soldiers tried to reach the wreckage, helicopter gunships destroyed it with rocket fire. By 1500 hours, Colonel Moore had decided it was absolutely essential and safe enough for the remaining tactical elements of his troops to land. Although the eastern sector of the perimeter was still under enemy fire, the fire had slackened considerably because of the action of Moore's men, who had worked to push the communists back. Although by this time Colonel Moore was personally directing the helicopter traffic into the landing zone, 2 helicopters were disabled during the landing. One received enemy fire in the engine compartment while lifting off and had to make a forced landing in an open area just off to the northern edge of the landing zone. Another clipped the treetops with the main rotor blade when landing and could not be flown out. Both crews, who were uninjured, were evacuated while the helicopters secured by Company D troopers awaited lift out later. Other helicopter crews nevertheless continued to fly missions into the area, exhibiting great courage and audacity under fire. At the same time, all the attempts to reach the cutoff platoon were unsuccessful, even though Colonel Moore's men got within 75 yards of their position. Nevertheless, Colonel Moore decided to give it one more try. He ordered Companies A and B to prepare for a coordinated attack, supported by heavy preparatory fires, to reach the beleaguered platoon. And meanwhile, the situation of the isolated and cutoff force grew progressively worse. Lieutenant Herrick and his men sorely needed the reinforcements that Colonel Moore was attempting to send. The North Vietnamese laced the small perimeter with fire so low to the ground that few of Herrick's men were able to employ their entrenching tools to provide themselves cover. Through it all, the men returned the fire, taking a heavy toll of the enemy. Sergeant Savage, firing his M16, hit 12 of the enemy himself during the course of the afternoon. In mid-afternoon, Lieutenant Herrick, who was commanding the cutoff platoon, was hit by a bullet which entered his hip, coursed through his body, and went out through his right shoulder. Now, that's a long way for a bullet to go through a man. As he lay dying, the lieutenant continued to direct his perimeter defense. In his last few moments, he gave his signal operation instructions book to Sergeant Carl Palmer, his platoon sergeant, with orders to burn it if captured. He told Palmer to redistribute the ammunition, call in artillery fire, and at the first opportunity try to make a break for it. Sergeant Palmer, himself already slightly wounded, had no sooner taken command than he too was killed, end quote. Colonel Hal Moore picks up the story. Lieutenant Herrick organized his small force on a hill and then shouted to the machine gun crews outside the perimeter to come up the hill. The one closest to the perimeter disengaged and scrambled up the knoll into the tiny American perimeter. The other kept firing to cover the withdrawal. It came under attack by a large number of enemy who swarmed all around the crew. It was during this desperate melee that Herrick's platoon suffered its worst casualties and lost one of its precious machine guns. Sergeant Savage picks up the story. The enemy were past the machine gun before it ever quit firing. I could hear Sergeant Hurdle down there cursing. Even over the firefight, I heard him. He was famous for that. Son of a bitch! You mother effer! Come on! I could hear him hollering that down there. Then they threw grenades in on him. There was no more screaming after that. The enemy turned the captured M60 around and started using it on the Americans on the hill. That's when Sergeant Anderson started screaming that his face was on fire. You see, it was on fire. Fragments from a white phosphorus grenade were smoking and smoldering in his flesh. Sergeant Zalin tripped Anderson, and with Savage's help, they used bayonets to scrape and dig the burning Willy Peter fragments, burning Anderson's face out of his visage. The enemy, more than 150 strong, now attacked the knoll from 3 sides, north, south, and east, and soldiers on both sides were falling. Lieutenant Herrick ran from trooper to trooper, trying to get a defense organized. An enemy volley cut across Herrick and 3 more men. The men on the hill were dropping like flies. A modern historian takes up the story. The second squad leader, Palmer, took charge. He rose on his hands and knees and mumbled to no one in particular that he was going to get the platoon out of danger. He had just finished the sentence when a bullet smashed into his head. Killed in the same hail of bullets was the forward observer for the 81mm mortar. The artillery reconnaissance sergeant, who had been traveling with the platoon, was shot in the neck. Seriously wounded, he became delirious, and the men had difficulty keeping him quiet. Sergeant Savage, the third squad leader, now took command. Snatching the artilleryman's radio, he began calling in and adjusting artillery fire. Within minutes, he had ringed the perimeter with well-placed concentrations of fire, some as close to the position as 20 meters. The fire did much to discourage attempts to overrun the perimeter, but the platoon's position still was precarious. Of the 27 men in the platoon, 8 had been killed and 12 wounded, leaving less than a squad of effectives, end quote. Meanwhile, a little more than 100 yards away, Hal Moore was organizing another rescue attempt for Sergeant Savage and his cutoff comrades. It was about 4:20 in the afternoon when two companies of Americans set out to rescue the lost platoon. The attack was preceded by a rocket and artillery bombardment. Then the two companies set out into the yellow elephant grass and heavily wooded jungle, perfect terrain for a well-motivated enemy to solve the great mystery of human existence. What happens when you die? A few hundred North Vietnamese were dug in and couldn't wait to let the Americans find out. From the beginning, the attackers met heavy resistance. The communists were dug into one-man foxholes called spider holes. They knew exactly where the American reinforcements would be heading, and they were ready to meet them. Captain Tony Nadal was leading the assault, and this is what he saw, quote, "We moved out about 50 yards when we ran to enemy forces, which had moved down from the mountain. I mean, the fighting quickly became very vicious at close range. It was barbaric, man. We took many casualties. Lieutenant Wayne Johnson was hit. At least 3 squad leaders was also hit, 2 of them killed. One while going forward in an attempt to rescue one of his soldiers, even though he was acting against a direct order," end quote. The man was brave, but bravery wasn't enough. Life is often like that. You do all you can, but for some reason, it just doesn't work out. If only our wives could understand it, like our better military leaders do. Sergeant Troy Miller was in the fight. He remembers the battle like this, quote, "Right after Lieutenant Johnson was hit, Sergeant Billy Elliott, one of my squad leaders, yelled out, 'We got a man killed!' It was Ramon Bernard. He was just 25 years old. We were pushing forward when we ran into heavy small arms and automatic fire, mostly from AK-47s, end quote. Lieutenant Dennis Deal later recalled the battle as a storm of lead. He wrote this, quote, "We stood up and started the assault, and the whole world just exploded around us. I don't know how many Vietnamese there were. I couldn't see 90% of them, but I sure heard their weapons zinging and pinging all around me like a pinball machine. We had men dropping all over the place. Finally, the assault line went down to our knees and then down to a low crawl. I mean, you had to. It was instinctual. One of my men, I mean right in front of me, absorbed the full impact of a rocket-propelled grenade. The soldier was simply a mess, his body covered in shredded goo. It was like he turned a human being inside out, something from the horror movie Hellraiser. The soldier asked me if I had any morphine. I said, 'No, nothing.' I said, 'Joe, just crawl towards that tree.' He did. He got there, and the sergeant took care of him. I took his place on the battle line and was now basically a rifleman. I turned and I saw a human wave, like an offensive line of blitzing football players coming towards my right flank. I screamed and yelled incoherently, and one of my machine gunners got up and walked through all this fire and started lasering death into them from the hip. Their bodies were flipping and turning like in the opening of that movie, The Wild Bunch. I had never seen anything like it. I went along with them and we killed them all. We got rid of them. Then we returned to the assault line to do it all over again. I don't know how I survived. I still don't." End quote. As these two eyewitnesses explained, men on both sides were dropping like sacks of potatoes. The combat was simply brutal. A novelist provides this sordid description of the obscene combat, quote, "Sergeant Tuan Tran wormed through the knee-high elephant grass. He was used to the jungle. He'd been living in it for months, and he felt at home in the elephant grass. However, the shrapnel raining down from the American grenade launchers plucked on his nerves the way Paganini worked a violin. Almost soundlessly, his 20-man squad belly crawled towards the American line. His men were waiting for his signal. Tran's heart was a bass drum, hammering his chest with each pump of blood. Then he slapped the man's shoulder next to him. It was time. The soldier, whose name was Nam Phan, nodded slowly. The smallest man in the squad, he got up on one knee to fire the rocket-propelled grenade at the American line. It was the signal for the start of the attack. 1, counted Tuan. The soldier next to him flipped the safety switch. 2, slowly, imperceptibly, the soldier aims the rocket. 3, whispered Tuan, almost without sound. As the rocket exploded in front of the American lines, sending shrapnel and dirt spraying into their big faces, 20 die-hard North Vietnamese rose to their feet, banana clips regurgitating in their Kalashnikov rifles, spewing haphazard death as they came on. Most of them didn't even aim. They worked death the way kindergartners scribble. Private John Maxwell had been staring into the jungle overgrowth like a scholar absorbed in a perfect book. He hadn't seen a thing when the RPG exploded, sending a tidal wave of detritus into his disbelieving face. Vaguely, he registered wounded men screaming for help around him. Through stunned eyes, he saw a line of screaming communists running at him, their rifles already spitting death as they came on. Maxwell didn't hesitate. Without thinking, he clambered, crab-like, out of his shallow foxhole and began working his M60 machine gun into the onrushing Vietnamese. Their bodies burst apart like a physical obscenity, a tangible, materialized violation of the eternal moral law, shaking as he shot, working from the hip, and then, expert-like, flicking his pointer finger on the trigger to fire well-aimed two-round bursts, John Maxwell worked a concerto of grueling pain into the screaming NVA soldiers, painting their tan uniforms red with their own blood, pinking the brown bark of the underbrush with their pulped insides. And you should have heard the sound of the gun made, a chattering happy sound, as if the gun itself delighted in finally executing its purpose. A scientist had designed and refined the M60 just for this one moment, and the sliding bolt pumping bullets faster than the eye could see testified to the intelligence of man when he sets his mind to killing his fellow man. A meat processor takes fresh venison and churning, cutting, and slicing spews out hamburger meat just so. Maxwell's machine gun turned North Vietnamese shoulder into processed beef, blowing quivering shrimp-resembling brains across the verdant, wide-leaved jungle. Sausage-looking entrail snaked out from bodies the way jellyfish tentacles haphazardly spill from the fish's head. Walking from position to position, he resembled a chunky John Rambo, his fat baby face trembling as the automatic fire shook his body. Days later, when he was back at base, he took off his dirt and sweat-crusted shirt and was amazed by what he saw. His entire right arm and chest was black and blue from the M60 stock that had tenderized his chubby body the way sous chefs work veal. And Maxwell's right hand resembled rotting veal, putrescent and covered in blisters from the weight and violence of the gun he had used to stop the North Vietnamese in their tracks. He looked like shit, but you should have seen the other guys, or rather, you couldn't see many of them. Their rotting bodies had been devoured by the happy birds and animals of the jungle. No one ever saw Sergeant Tuan Tran again. End quote. A historian picks up the story, quote, "That's when Lieutenant Marm's men forged ahead until enemy machine gun fire, which seemed to come from an anthill 30 meters to their front, stopped them. Deliberately exposing himself in order to pinpoint the exact enemy location, Marm fired an M72 anti-tank round at the earth mound. He inflicted some casualties, but the enemy fire continued. Figuring that it would be a simple matter to dash up to the position and toss a grenade behind it, he motioned to one of his men to do so. At this point, the noise and confusion was such that a sergeant near him interpreted the gesture as a command to throw one from his position. He tossed, and the grenade, of course, fell short. Disregarding his own safety, Marm dashed quickly across the open stretch of ground and hurled a grenade into the position, killing some of the enemy soldiers behind it and finishing off the day's survivors with his M16 in close-range fighting. Soon afterward, he took a bullet in his face and had to be evacuated. Captain Nadal watched the casualties mount as his men attempted to inch forward. All of his platoon leaders were dead or wounded, and his artillery forward observer had been killed. Four of his men were killed within 6 feet of him personally, including Jackie Gell, his communications sergeant, who had been filling in as his radio operator. It was a little past 5 o'clock, and soon it would be dark. Nadal's platoons had moved only 150 meters, and the going was tougher all the time. Convinced that he could not break through, he called Colonel Moore and asked permission to pull back. The colonel gave it, end quote. As night fell, Colonel Moore repositioned his 7 companies in an all-around defense pattern very similar to the logger battle strategy used by Afrikaners throughout South African history. Many of the companies dug in along a dry creek bed. Throughout the night, reinforcements and supplies poured into the Americans and the wounded were evacuated. During the night, the enemy would repeatedly probe Moore's position. Well-directed artillery and small arms fire drove them off. Sniping lasted through the night, and a man took his own life in his hands when he lit a cigarette. But the battle simmering around Moore in the landing zone was nothing compared to what the North Vietnamese did to the cut-off platoon. For these few forlorn men, the assaults would last through the night. John Cash provides the details of the night terror which awaited Moore's men. However, he rightly focuses on the fate of the cut-off platoon, which, if you remember, is under the command of Sergeant Savage. Throughout the night, the Communists launched massive assaults on the few unwounded survivors huddled around Savage. Quote, "During the early hours of darkness, Colonel Moore, accompanied by a sergeant major, made spot visits around the battalion perimeter, talking to the men. Although his troops were facing a formidable enemy force and had suffered quite a few casualties, their morale was clearly high. At intervals during the night, enemy forces harassed and probed the battalion perimeter, and each instance well-placed American artillery blunted the enemy's aggressiveness. Firing some 4,000 rounds, the two howitzer batteries also laced the fingers and draws of the mountain where lights had been seen. Tactical air missions were flown throughout the night. The remnants of Sergeant Savage's isolated little band, meanwhile, continued to be hard-pressed. 3 times the enemy attacked with at least a reinforced platoon, but were turned back by the artillery and small arms fire of the men in the perimeter, including some of the wounded. Charles Luce, the company's senior medical aid man, moved around the perimeter, exposed to fire while he administered care to the wounded. His diligence and ingenuity throughout the day and the night saved at least 6 lives. Having run out of first aid packets as well as bandages from his own bag, he used the sea ration toilet tissue packets most of the men had with them to help stop bleeding. Calm, sure, and thoroughly professional, he brought reassurance to the men. Before the second attack, which came at 3:45 in the morning, bugle calls were heard around the entire perimeter. Some sounds seemed to come from Chu Pong Mountain itself. Sergeant Savage could even hear enemy soldiers muttering softly to each other in the sing-song cadence of their language. He called down a 15-minute artillery barrage to saturate the area and followed it with a tactical airstrike on the ground just above the positions. Executed under flareship illumination, the two strikes in combination broke up the attack. The sergeant noted the illumination exposed his position and it was therefore not used again that night. A third and final attack came over an hour later and was as unsuccessful as the previous two. Sergeant Savage and his men, isolated but still holding out throughout the night, could hear and sometimes see the enemy dragging off his dead and wounded, end quote. All during the night, the Vietnamese snaked men around Moore's position, ready for the apocalyptic battle that was sure to follow the next day. At the same time, Colonel Moore was preparing yet another attack to rescue Sergeant Savage's cut-off platoon. As he planned, he could hear them fighting for their very lives a few hundred yards away, and it tore at Moore's soul to hear the battle raging. The next morning, there would be hell for breakfast. But that's next month's podcast. And that's another one in the books for me. As always, I want to thank everyone who tells a friend about the show, and especially everyone who buys us around. Also, I've gotten like a streak of hate mail lately, so if you enjoy the show, do me a favor and give me a good review. Make me feel good about myself. Next month, we're going to have a hell of a battle, I can tell you. But until then, I'm Dr. Luke Wolf, and I'm wishing you good times and good weather with good people. Bye. And you know what? Crack one with me. Ice cold.